MacCast, Friday, February 21st, 2014. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, I have a fun show for you today. You know, there's been kind of a little lull in what's going on with Apple news. We've got a lot of rumors and speculation about the iPhone 6 and Apple TVs and all this stuff that we talk about all the time on the show. And so I like it when I have an opportunity to kind of break out of the MacCast mold for an episode and bring you something that many of you have been asking about, actually give you some information that a lot of you have asked me about, and that is about being self-employed, leaving your day job and starting up something like the MacCast or some other project to kind of break out on your own and do your own thing. And a lot of people are curious about the process and what it's like. And I recently discovered and found out that somebody we know from the MacCast community, well-known guy, Brett Terpstra, you might know him from Envy Alt or Marked or just the myriad of, I think this guy is probably the hardest, one of the hardest working guys in the Mac community. He was doing a day job and somehow found time to crank out all these great projects. You can check them all out on his website, brettterpstra.com. But I just found out recently that he left his day gig and is going full time with his programming and projects that he's been working on. He also does some writing. He did a book with our friend David Sparks on Mountain Lion Tips, 60 Mountain Lion Tips, if I remember. I'm probably mutilating the title, so sorry about that, Brett. But I was able to get Brett on and talk about sort of that whole process about, you know, moving from your day job, your full-time gig, into your own thing and what that process is like. And of course, I went through that same process about four years ago now with the MacCast. So we just share our insights and I hope you find it very, very informative. But before we get into the interview, I want to take a quick moment and thank a couple of our show sponsors. Starting off with lynda.com. Lynda.com is a site. They offer high quality video courses that can help anyone who's in the creative software business fields learn and expand their skills. Also photography, design, all these sorts of things. Anything you're going to do with your Mac, they have great courses where you can train yourself and learn new skills. And one of my favorite things about lynda.com is just how many courses they have and the variety of courses. Over 2,000 different courses, and they're adding new stuff all the time. Every time I go back in there, they've got a bunch of great new courses. I think I told you last time there's a bunch of new iOS courses and intro to iOS courses that you can take advantage of. But I'm a web developer, and I've found it extremely helpful in helping keep up to date on all of my skills, because there's new technologies coming out all the time, things like Node.js and different frameworks and stuff that I need to learn. And I can always just pop into lynda.com, and they usually have something that I can just sit down and watch and get myself up to speed with the latest and greatest technology. So if you want to check it out, there's a great offer right now for MacCast listeners. You can try it out. Just go to lynda.com/MacCast, and you're going to get free trial access to the entire library. You can drill down. You can get into all the nitty-gritty, go through the entire course, any of the courses that you want. It's like all you can eat, all for free on the trial. And when you're ready to sign up, they have full access plans starting as low as just $25 a month. And another cool thing is they also have gift subscriptions. So if you know somebody who could benefit from the great content they have over there, a student maybe a family member who's looking to expand their technology skills, give them a gift subscription, send it to them. So you can check it all out. And also I have a list of some of my recommended courses if you go to lynda.com/MacCast. So they made a little playlist. I went through the library, picked out some courses I thought would be of particular interest to MacCast listeners like yourself. So be sure to check those out too. That's lynda.com, lynda.com/Maccast. And there you can get all the details on all the different service plans and everything that they have to offer. And a big thank you to Lynda for their support of the Maccast. I'd also like to thank Smile. You know Smile, they make Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, all applications that I use and love. And something cool that's been going on lately with Smile is they've really expanded the PDF Pen family. So if you have to work with PDFs, you want to be able to do things like fill out forms, to add your signature. Myself, I've gone paperless, so I rely on PDF Pen to help manage, edit, update, change all of my PDFs. But what's awesome now is that with PDF Pen, you now have a family of products, something that can go on any platform, and you can work seamlessly across using cloud services like iCloud or Dropbox. They also support Evernote, Box.net, Google Docs. You have PDF Pen for the Mac, PDF Pen for the iPad, PDF Pen for your iPhone, so you can open and manage and edit all of your documents there. And they recently added PDF Pen Scan Plus to the lineup, meaning that if you need to capture an image, capture a PDF, you can do it right from your mobile device, your iPhone, your iPad. You just snap a quick picture. It'll find the edges. It'll help manage the skewing. You can do some color corrections, get it in black and white, grayscale, color, whatever you want. Pull it in and then send it straight over to PDF Pen for iPhone, iPad, Mac. Make additional edits, annotations, save that off, send it out in an email, send it to your favorite cloud service. It's just really awesome stuff, and it just works all seamlessly together because it's all in that PDF Pen family. So you really should check it out. They have a great video that explains the whole family of PDF Pen products. You can check that out on the Smile website. Just head over to smilesoftware.com and check it all out. And a big thank you to Smile for their support of the Maccast. And with that, let's jump right into my conversation with Brett Terpstra about breaking free of the day job and moving into doing your own thing. Hey, Brett, how you doing?
I am awesome.
Hey, thanks for agreeing to come on and talk to us a little bit about what you've been up to lately. But I also want to get a little bit into some of your past and history and stuff like that. I think I mentioned to you right before we started that I'd been having this idea to kind of get some folks who are, you know, well-known in the Mac community, and people I sure recognize your name, but if they don't, they'll know you very well by the end of this interview, I hope. Just get them on and talk about sort of how we ended up where we ended up and maybe some of the tools that we use to get things done with our Macs and the technology. But really just want to start out getting a little bit of your background. So what I'm curious about, and I think other people will be too, is sort of how did you end up being a technology sort of guy? I think we all kind of have similar stories, but I'm very curious, like, where did computers and technology start to become a thing for you in your life?
Well, my dad was a mechanical engineer, and he's always been pretty tech savvy, and he brought home a IBM PC Junior when I was six.
Oh, wow.
And after, I think we had it for all of a week before I found Logo and Basic. And I was going to a private school at the time, and I had a friend who was in, what's that, like kindergarten, first grade? I don't even remember.
First grade, but, yeah.
But he was starting to study geometry at that point. The kid was a genius.
Wow.
And he was composing in Logo. He was making these like fractal patterns, like insane stuff. And he taught me a lot, and it got my interest. And I didn't ever consider myself a developer, like growing up through high school and everything. I wanted to be a musician and more creative pursuits, because at that point I didn't consider programming creative. It was something I enjoyed doing. I ran VBSs and scripted home automation and all this stuff, but I didn't think about being called a developer until well after college. And I realized over the course of my early 20s that coding and developing is a very creative pursuit. It's very parallel to music composition and painting, and it's all creative problem solving. So that was kind of a long journey to that conclusion, but
it's really interesting that you mentioned the music thing, because I've heard that from other developers too, where they sort of had musical interests but then found a lot of similarities between coding and development and the music creation process.
Oh, it is absolutely similar.
Huh. And I played music and stuff like that as a kid, but I never really kind of got into, deeper into just playing an instrument, like being in high school jazz band and stuff like that. Like what kind of elements do you find are helpful,
Sure.
Music decoding.
So when I've never articulated this before, so it might be stumbly, but
yeah, no worries.
when you sit down to write a song, you have generally some idea of what the finished product should be when you start, even right. if it's a vague notion. And then you start playing with chords, you start putting together sequences, and you figure out how to accomplish your goal. Along the way, that goal may change because you discover things. You have happy accidents. You find you can't do certain things, and you solve those problems as they come up, and then you put it all together and you instrument it in a way that if it's a multi-instrument composition, you have to make sure everything's working together. And in programming, you start with the idea for the application, the problem you want to solve,
right?
And you start putting the pieces together, and you have to make everything tie in. You build classes and you build libraries that can work with each other, that you can orchestrate. And the thought process is very, very similar for me.
Yeah, that's a great explanation. That makes actually a lot of sense. So being off the top of your head, that was pretty good.
Hey, thanks.
Yeah, but I can kind of see that, right? You're kind of building out these segments, and it seems very object oriented, I guess is what I'm getting at,
yeah,
right?
You yeah, have, that's
you're, like,
good.
Your functions and things that you're building out almost act like maybe different passages or different
exactly
portions of the piece, or maybe even different instruments, and then that idea of sort of assembling them together into a cohesive piece, that makes a lot of sense. I think there's actually, it's interesting that you bring up that whole creative pursuit, because I kind of have that in my background too, and I kind of fell into coding. I originally wanted to be a graphic designer. Well, actually I started out wanting to be a cartoonist, and then went through graphic design. I actually have my background in printing technology, throwing ink on paper, and just sort of found my way through there into doing page layout and design work, and then slowly into web development, and it just sort of snowballed from there.
I'll tell you real quick. My art school was my college degree.
Mm-hmm.
I studied graphic design and interactive multimedia, and then I headed into web design. But yeah, it seems to be a common pursuit as well.
Yeah, but I think that creative process does help in the coding, and a lot of people often think that those are two wholly separate things. But I think you're right. I'm finding and meeting more and more people where that's their background. They do have some sort of design or artistic kind of background, and I think it goes into that whole sort of balance. If you have a little bit of all of it, you seem to be able to generate a better product, I think, in the end. It's that, I guess it's almost cliche, it's that classic Apple thing, right, that Steve Jobs always said, which was, the meeting of how did he always put it, the meeting of the liberal arts and technology, right?
Yeah. See, I would clarify the point and say that all of these things parallel Mac development. Like, you get into the Windows and Linux communities and you find less of this kind of crossover between music and art and code.
Yeah.
It's a very, like, people who have that background find a home on the Mac. So it's kind of, I think it's, it, there, these parallels are specific to a platform. And Apple's made something really great for people with those creative minds.
Right, right. And I've often found, too, that's sort of like the gateway. I've met people where it's like, well, I got into the Mac because it allowed me to create music, or I got into the Mac because it allowed me to do the graphics that I wanted to do. And then through just working with it and maybe hitting a limitation or something like that. And I have a feeling maybe this is some of the ways that you delve deeper into programming too, was that, you know, they hit a stumbling block and went, well, maybe I can figure out how to solve that myself. And then they sort of get into programming through, it's like, I just wanted to make this piece of my music work, or I wanted to get this sound, or I wanted to figure out this thing. And I realized, well, I could kind of get in through, you know, whether it's something simple like AppleScript or something, you know, figuring out a workflow, but they would start to dive in, right, and realize, then get under the hood and then become more technical.
Can I tell you a quick anecdote that'll prove your point?
Yeah.
It was like 2005, I think. And I had, you know, like I said, I'd run BBSs. I'd done some light coding, scripting mostly, and hadn't really dived into it at that point.
Dove, yeah.
But then I was reading the unofficial Apple weblog, and someone presented a question about whether they could post updates to multiple social services at the same time. Mm-hmm. And it intrigued me. And I started playing with AppleScript to make it happen, and got frustrated with the limitations and complexity of doing like lower level scripting in AppleScript, and started to learn Cocoa, AppleScript Studio, actually.
Right.
And built an app called Mood Blast that worked with like 12 different services at the time. And all of a sudden, I was recognized as a developer. And I just started, once having solved that problem, I dove in and just started solving every problem I could find.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of a snowball effect. I want to jump back a little bit because you mentioned, which amazing, you know, getting into programming at age 6, mm-hmm. even if it's just basic and Logo and stuff like that. But you mentioned that was a PC Junior. Do you remember what your first introduction to the Mac was, and what the first Mac you had was?
I very well do. It was when I swore I would never get a Mac all the way through probably the end of college. I went to art school with a PC.
Mm-hmm.
And
how was that?
I used the Macs in the lab.
Right.
But this was OS 9.
Uh-huh.
And I still hated it. I still didn't see the appeal. It was the year that OS 10 came out. I was working as an art director, and I demanded that I get a Mac because I had seen what OS 10 could do, and the Unix subsystem intrigued me. And that my first Mac then would have been like 2004. So I'm late to the game,
mm-hmm.
but I would never go back to PC now.
And do you remember what the Mac was in 2004?
It was one of those unibody things, like kind of like the 2E grown up. What were an iMac? Was that already called an iMac? I can't remember.
Yeah,
first one that I owned personally was a MacBook Pro 17 inch.
Oh, okay, so for work they got you like a all in one. It probably would have been an iMac at that time, I would think.
The first one, yeah. I think we got a G5 after a while.
Yeah.
But I don't remember if that was,
because they had the education one. They had the eMac, but that was really sold mainly to education. Other people could get a hold of them, but
it was better than that. It was a higher power machine.
Yeah,
did the job.
Well, very, very cool. So in college you're doing art, it sounds like, and that's your degree. So after you get out, I mean, how does your career progress?
Well, I should say in college, I was doing art with computers.
Okay.
I took painting and photography and all of that, but my focus was programming the web. And at that point, we were still working in Director and JavaScript 1, and it wasn't stuff that necessarily directly applies to what I do today, but it used the same part of my brain, and that started to intrigue me. And then I got a job and worked my way up to art director in a fashion company. And as art director, I began to try to make things more efficient, the processes for creating posters and all of these things, and ended up really getting into automation and everything from like Photoshop scripting to actual like AppleScript processes. And then after a year of being art director, I quit and started my own design firm, going into web design, primarily web design, still doing print design and marketing, but I got really heavily into web design, and I was the only person in my small firm that could do a web design. Mm-hmm. And so it honed my skills pretty quickly. And then I quit that and then headed to, well, I freelanced for a while and then ended up at AOL.
Huh. So when you say you were doing web design, I'm assuming you were doing both front end and back end kind of stuff.
Yeah. It was
so mostly doing the coding and the design work as well.
Right. It was mostly WordPress and Joomla and what was that e-commerce platform I hated? Oh, Magento.
Oh, you don't like Magento?
Oh my God. You can take object-oriented programming to a point where it's really useful, and then you can go too far.
Yeah. Yeah, I've never really worked with it too much, but I think Magento is one of those e-com platforms that's based on Zen Framework, if I'm not mistaken, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah.
And I had worked, when I was working at Nick Software, as a matter of fact, we were building an e-com platform. We ended up custom building one using Zen Framework, so we kind of wrote it from the ground up. But
you have to. There are no good ones.
Yeah, we had looked into Magento for a bit.
Don't. I almost took a job with a company that specialized in Magento, but I'm really glad I didn't, because hacking that is just such a pain.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Anybody who's worked with e-com platforms, especially like turnkey ones, just kind of take an aside down the e-com route, I've just generally found that the problem is they'll get you up and running really quickly, often. Right. So it seems like it's going to be this great thing. But so many businesses are so specialized in terms of their needs that trying to build a one size fits all kind of, and this actually translates, I think, into a lot of other kinds of programming. But, you know, specifically with e-com, trying to build this sort of one size fits all platform really breaks down really, really quickly. And then you find you've got to like hack around or work around or hack in, and then you can't upgrade. I mean, it starts to become a real mess.
That's exactly the problem. That's what killed me about Magento, how long it took me to make it do what my clients needed, because everyone had different requirements.
Yeah, I don't know if that's just Magento, though. I think a lot of
well,
you're right.
You're right. Like I said, there are, at least last time I looked, there are no good solutions. I send people to the online stores like Shopify,
right?
And I have them just set up their shops there. And if it doesn't work out, I help them find someone who specializes in a particular e-commerce platform that knows it well enough that they don't spend the hours that I did trying to make it do what I need.
Right? Yeah. You kind of just have to. If you can't fit into the sort of turnkey box, you've got to really build your own, and it's, you know, it can be time consuming and expensive, but you're going to end up with something that works for you versus something that kind of works for you and you're unhappy with. But like I said, I think when you get into lots of different areas of programming, even building websites, you know, I do a lot of WordPress development now too, and it's a great platform and it's got a lot of flexibility, but still you're kind of often running into those points where it's like, it kind of works, and there's this add-on that kind of works, and it's okay, but it's really not doing exactly what I need to do. And at that point, you find that, like, I've got to write my own theme, or I've got to actually write my own add-ons or theme, you know,
but
that has the features in it that this specific client needs.
The plugin architecture, and that's where I think I really got into back-end programming. WordPress, you know, the code base is a little, it's got a lot of legacy stuff in it. It's not perfect. It's not like mint and beautiful like some of the newer ones, but the hooks and the plugin architecture that it provides means that once you know a little PHP,
right,
you can make it do just about anything.
Yeah. You just have to follow the rules. And then the problem is also, you know, some of these platforms will get a bad rap because you have developers too that kind of don't follow, you know, follow the rules that are set up.
Yeah.
They don't take the time to read the documentation and understand, okay, this is how hooks work and how you need to, you know, put stuff in so that your stuff doesn't break when we upgrade the core and when we make changes.
And that's stuff you learn as you go. Like a new developer is just, they're having a hard enough time figuring out how to make it work. And if they're anything like me, they just start banging on it with a hammer until something makes sense.
That's like me too. Yeah.
And then once you get it, once you start to understand it, then you go back and you figure out, especially if you want to share your code, you figure out how to make it future-proof and how to make it work with the system. But that's a secondary. For me, I got to go through the learning process before I can worry about the details.
Yeah, and that's actually a good thing to mention, because I will often get asked by people, you know, how do you get into this? How do you even get started? How do you
yeah, me too.
You know, where do you go? And your path sounds very similar to mine, and I discovered the same sort of thing. It's like you got to not really be afraid. I think there's a certain fear that comes into play where it's like you're afraid to even jump in, or it's like, I don't know what I'm doing, or I don't quite understand this. And, you know, maybe it's different types of personalities, but I think I'm more of a learn by doing sort of person. And so it is, it's just jumping in and, like you said, banging away at something with a hammer, just hacking something together, even if it's ugly, you know, mm-hmm. ugly code that you wouldn't want to show anybody else. Just the ability to sort of do that and ultimately get something working, even if it's not working efficiently.
Right. But, you know, but in the process, you learn how it works.
Exactly.
And then you can go back if you need to, and you can do the whole thing from scratch with better code, because it'll take you a tenth of the time because you have all the problems solved.
Right, right.
I can't learn any other way. Videos, books, like I can't do any of that stuff. I have to do it.
Yeah, you had to kind of hack in it. And what's great now is, I mean, we have so many great resources to help you out, you know, like Stack Exchange and GitHub. And I mean, there's just so
browsing,
many better
just
tools.
Browsing GitHub is the best tool I've ever had. I can't imagine having developed the skills I have now without being able to look at everyone else's code in the world. That's awesome.
Yeah, and that's actually another great tip, I think, for people who are just starting out. It's sort of like, just find somebody else's code on GitHub and like look in and see sort of what they're doing, because that also will help you kind of teach you some of the rules, and you'll slowly discover the people who are writing good stuff versus bad stuff. You can start to point it out and see it. And so just look at the really good people who are doing good work and dive into their code and just try and understand it. And you do learn a lot that way too.
Yep. And you learn multiple coding styles by looking at multiple people's code. And that's how you start to be able to discern what's elegant and what's horrible.
Yeah.
Cause I mean, if you start copying and pasting as a beginner, you'll get burned.
Yep.
You know, cause you'll have a disparate code base that uses multiple styles, and you won't know what half of them do. So you really have to kind of, like you said, pull it apart, figure out why it works, and then worry about how to re-implement it.
Yeah. The other thing is like there's always going to be code that could be made better or more efficient. And you talk to anybody who's been coding for a long time about their projects and things like that, and they can tell you, they'll be like, oh yeah, there's that thing and it's commercial and I put it out there and there's tons of people using it, but I, you know, there's
but
this part,
I don't want
anybody to know what I did over here. Cause it's hairy, but it works. I mean, and it gets the job done. So there is some points where it's just like, you got to go, you know, I got to just let that piece be and move on. It works. It may not be the best thing in the world. And I think all developers tell you they have that kind of code, and you know,
If you're not embarrassed by what you did 5 years ago, you're not learning anything.
Right.
Like everyone hates what they did 5 years ago, and everyone who's growing anyway.
Yeah. So you ended up at AOL for a while. I don't know. Is there anything? I'm trying to think if there's anything we need to talk about there other than the fact that you were there for a while.
No, there's actually a good story about how that started.
Okay.
I was talking about Mood Blast earlier.
Mm-hmm.
There was a blogger at the unofficial Apple weblog named David Chartier, later went on to write for Macworld and Ars Technica, and he took a real interest in Mood Blast and was probably its biggest promoter and the first time that I ever started getting serious traffic on my website. And over the course of, I don't know, maybe a year, we became pretty good friends, email-based, and when he left the unofficial Apple weblog, he suggested me as his replacement. So I gladly took the position, started
cool.
blogging
That's
for
a good recommendation.
Yeah. And And that was really exciting for me, especially at that time. I still love Tua.
Me too.
But they're owned by AOL, and using the CMS at Tua began to there are so many limitations on their proprietary CMS, and I started hacking together extensions, bundles for TextMate, and things that made it work with the way I wanted to work. And that got noticed, and they offered me a contract position working for AOL Tech, which is like Engadget and Tua and Joystick. And I had the background. I knew what I was doing, but it was on a new level, you know, dealing with Engadget, working with Engadget's code base, any site that has more than a million hits a day, it's a whole new level of stress. Every line of code you write, you want to be sure is not going to, you know, take the website down for 5 minutes and cost money.
Yeah. Yeah.
After I think I contracted for a year, and then a position opened up, the lead developer left and they brought me in as a full time. And then just that wasn't the lead developer, but a position opened up and they gave me a full time job. And then just months after that, the lead developer left and they said, "You've been doing great. Do you want the position?" And at the time, I was also working for Agile Bits.
Mm-hmm.
And I that's when I had to leave Agile Bits because I took the tech lead position. Doubled my salary. Everything was great. Had a blast for a few years doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. But I like you said, I would imagine it was pretty... I mean, it's pretty stressful. You're kind of...
You get used to it. At some point, you realize this is just a website and the money fluctuates. You know, it's not like every minute of downtime is money that can never be made up.
You know, it's funny.
You relax after a year.
It's funny that you mentioned that because I had a similar sort of epiphany at some point. I still get nervous anytime I'm deploying new code to a website. I don't know if you're like me. Like, I get butterflies in my stomach. Like, okay, I know I've tested this, you know, 10 ways from whatever, and it could just all fall apart, though. You never really know. But you're right. I mean, you reach a certain point when you realize it is just a website, right? It's like we're not doing brain surgery here.
Right. And there's the average person who followed a link to your website, doesn't know you, doesn't know the company behind it at all, and they get a 404 and they'll never come back. You lost a potential viewer, but your bread and butter, all the people who are used to your site and recognize it, they'll be back. They'll check back. They'll send you emails. Your site's down. Fix it. And, you know, they're trying to help. And sometimes more angrily than others. But
well, you find it hard to not to take that stuff personally, too, I think. That's. I mean, if you're a developer, I mean, because I care about the quality of my work and I care about my code. And when someone, you know, when something happens or goes wrong and someone's hypercritical of it, you know, it hurts.
Last time we relaunched Engadget, the design previous to the current one.
Yeah.
I had to take myself off the mailing list because there were so many, hundreds a day, vehement people swearing, calling us names, threatening to never come back. They hated what we did. And yeah, that was personal. I don't know. I think that was the beginning of the end for me.
I think that goes back a little bit to this whole, you know, the start of this conversation where being creative people and a creative process... I mean, a lot of people think this is just a technical thing, right? This is engineering. This is just code and bits and stuff like that. But to me, and I don't know about to you, but to me, you know, it's like it's my creation. It's the mm-hmm. thing that I built and I, you know, put a lot of time and effort and thought into.
It's your Mona Lisa.
Yeah, exactly. Each one of these sorts of things.
Yeah.
So, yeah, let's talk a little bit about the decision to move on, because that's a little bit scary too. And I get a lot of people asking me about that because, you know, I did this. This is actually, honestly, this is the second time I've done it because it is so kind of scary. But about it's been about 5 years now. You know, I decided I'm going to leave my job, you know, my safe, secure job at Nick Software with the retirement plan and the healthcare plan and all that nice stuff, and see if I can make this whole MacCast thing work. you know, full time, and it's still, I'm still not there full time with the podcast. You know, I do web development work to kind of make ends meet, but I've been on my own for, you know, 5 years now, and it's been great. But let's talk about that decision, because it is kind of a hard decision process. So how did that go for you?
Well, it started with some discontent. I had done it previously. I'd quit my job at the first company and gone freelance.
Right.
And I had failed pretty miserably at that. Ended up horribly in debt and desperate for a job.
Right.
But I learned a lot in that process. And this time around, I started feeling some discontent, and things were never horrible at AOL. But I wasn't as happy as I was those first few years.
Right.
And so I started weighing the options, started seeing how much money I was making on the side, which was, I was basically equaling my paycheck with side projects at that point. And the only unfortunate side to that is you get used to the income.
Right.
And leaving your job means cutting it in half and then some, because you're paying more taxes and you're paying health insurance out of pocket. And so I was pretty sure, though, and I'm not good at math, but I was pretty sure I could make it. The real challenge was convincing everyone else, my wife and my parents and my banks and whatnot, that I could do this.
Right.
I don't get scared by those kind of decisions. I have it would be a gambling addiction if I had the option to gamble. I really like taking risks like that, turns me on. I just,
so you see it more excited. As a challenge, maybe, is that fair to say?
It's, yeah, sort of like, exactly.
Yeah.
I just, if there were no other considerations, you know, other than keeping myself alive, I would dive into that decision so quickly. But yeah. I did. I have more considerations these days. I have a mortgage and a wife and
right.
And
you have responsibilities outside for. Yourself.
Yeah. And I still, I have some debt left over from my miserable failure as a freelancer. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, I have to consider all of those things. And, you know, I waited as much as I could before I just said, I'm not currently happy. I think I could be happy. Let's do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I found too that sort of that first leap, you know, where you try and you fail and then you have to go back to a day job. I mean, I went through that exact same experience. So I was at Upper Deck, the trading card company, for a number of years doing, that's where I did, you know, first got into doing some e-com work. And actually that was all Microsoft C#.net programming. So I was a Microsoft programmer for a few years. But when I left that, I thought, you know, I'm going to go off and I'm going to do this freelance thing, because it was something that I always wanted to do. And I kind of wanted to work for myself. I was tired of just working for other people. And you know, it was the same kind of thing. I did it for about 9 months and it just wasn't taking off. I wasn't getting any traction. And then it was, you know, slowly eating through my savings. And it just became inevitable that I'm going to have to go back to a day job. But I think, like you said, you learn a lot in that process. So it made this second leap of faith after Nick a lot easier. And I ended up, I think, because of it, being able to be more successful. So that's one bit of advice I've given to a lot of people, is like, sometimes you just got to do it. You know, you just got to go for it and see what happens. And, you know, but I think the second time around too, I had that experience of knowing, you know, hey, I felt like I could always fall back on a day job. And the second time around for me, I went, you know what? I'm not going to have that be an option. I'm going to like really stick it out and figure out how to make this thing work. And I don't know if that led to it being more successful the second time around. I think, well, it was a little bit of the experience and a little bit of the attitude. I had a different attitude the second time around, and I don't know if you had a similar.
Absolutely. You have to want it.
Yeah.
You have to not say, I'm going to try this, because it's too risky for that kind of attitude.
Yeah.
You have to want it. And I made a harder decision yesterday. I was headhunted. I think I'm allowed to talk about this. I was headhunted by Google while I was at AOL. And I started the interview process with them to see what would happen. And I made it very far in the interview process. And yesterday, the day before the final remote interview, I emailed and said that I don't think I want the job. I said, I really, I want to be independent right now.
Yeah.
And And like, that's kind of that proved to me that I had more than just a fleeting kind of dream. It was a plan.
Yeah. Yeah. It's something and you get hit with those hard decisions too. You know, I've had the same sort of thing where people come to you and just like the offer you can't refuse, but I think when you find that you can, then you know that you're really on the path that you want to be on.
Yeah. And that's a really good feeling. That makes getting up in the morning more fun, because you're doing what you're passionate about. You're doing what you meant to be doing.
Yeah.
Not something that fell in your lap.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of the stuff that you are doing, some of your projects. So I think the first time I found out about you and sort of what you were doing was I started hearing things about Envy Alt, I think was the very first thing. And maybe through David Sparks, I don't remember. So, and then later when again, David has been a huge influence on me. So David Sparks got me into using Markdown and that whole thing. And then that's when I discovered Marked. And then it was just like, oh, this is awesome stuff. And then I go, over to your projects page. And now I think I understand a little bit more why you have so many projects on your projects page. But I mean, you've done a lot of stuff.
You know, I have to pick and choose what I put on that page.
I mean, you've got all kinds of, stuff that you've thrown up there. But I think Marked is the big one right now. And I don't know if that's where it is for you or what you're up to. But is that kind of your focus at this point?
Yeah. As far as development goes, Marked is getting the most attention, because I'm writing books and I'm speaking at Macworld and doing a video for Pearson Peach Pit, mm-hmm. and all of these things. And I'm trying to balance them all. But when I sit down to develop, 90% of the time it's for Marked. The other 10% of the time it's for quick one-off services, scripts, solutions that I find very relaxing to do. And it's kind of my free time thing.
So throughout this conversation, as we're talking about, moving into this stuff and looking at the stuff that you're doing, is it fair to say that you have a pretty big interest in sort of workflow? It seems like a lot of the tools and stuff that you're building are related to workflow kind of stuff.
Yes, it's a huge interest. It's like it's like a drug for me. It's something that I aspire to, and I'm constantly trying to create the perfect workflow and constantly changing it. So therefore I am personally inefficient and always down rabbit holes. But what I create because of it, I'm told, helps a lot of people avoid those rabbit holes.
Yeah, so you're kind of like the R&D lab for workflows for certain people, and then you're developing tools along the way that then you can share and sort of give out to the community and say, here, I figured this out. Here's the tools to make it work, and here's how you do it. Because I think another big part of what you do that I really appreciate is the blogging and the posts and the writing that go along with this stuff. I think that's
what makes it worthwhile for me.
Yeah,
like I'll work for free, and I for a long time have tried to avoid contract work with people. Mm-hmm. But if they have an interesting problem that I think more than one person has, I'm happy to solve it for free as long as I can share it on the blog. And that's not because it makes money there. It's not because it does anything other than make me feel like the time was worthwhile. I get, I get thank yous from people, and that means a lot to me. And part of it's magnanimous. Part of it's just, I don't know, like sharing things on the blog has been a passion for years now. And it's I don't know. I solve problems specifically so I can share them sometimes.
So let's talk about, I want to talk about Marked, because like I said, I use that product and I know you're doing some new stuff with it. And specifically, I'm kind of curious, so how did that workflow sort of come up, and how did you end up developing Marked to begin with?
Okay.
And, so, and maybe tell people what it, I guess we should maybe start off telling people what it is.
Okay, yeah. At its core, I'll explain what it is as I tell the story. We'll hit two birds. I had developed an interest in file system activity and watching files. and at the same time had run into my own problem and heard it from other people that some of their favorite text editors didn't have a Markdown preview and there was no way to add it. So I realized that I could create an application that watched the file system. When any editor saved to the file, it could update a Markdown preview. So it's not live as you type, but it's live as you progress through the document. And it works with whatever editor you want to run it with. Anything that puts a text file on your disk, you can use with Marked. And I pieced together the idea and then wrote the first version of Marked on a road trip, sitting in a front seat with a MacBook Air on the way to New Mexico. And that was... It was done by the time that vacation ended.
Wow.
And put it up on the App Store. I hadn't initially planned to put it on the App Store, but I realized there's this new thing, this new marketing platform where I could get heavy distribution, and it took off. It got the press it needed, and it got the attention from Apple that it needed. And it's, you know, the original version of Marked is still on the App Store. It's like a few bucks, $4. And it still is always in the top 50, at least when I was still checking, in the top 50 in its category. For the longest time, it was top 10, top 20. It's been dropping, though, because I started working on Mark 2. And when they implemented sandboxing, I Marked 1 wasn't sandboxed, and it couldn't be. And so it's kind of dead in the water right now. It can get fixes, and I support it. But my focus went to Mark 2, which takes the idea of the basic, look, you can preview Markdown, to let's make a useful writing tool that has built-in keyword highlighting, customizable keyword highlighting lists. It has a word repetition feature that can show you when you use words too often in the same paragraph or throughout your document, word count, readability, like everything from Gunning Fog indexes to basic like grade scores. All of this, all these tools that would help me write better. And then a lot of requests that had come up with Marked 1 got implemented. And that's currently only available outside the App Store, but I am presently working on getting it into the App Store. A few niggles to work out with sandboxing it, but it's going to happen. So, that's all development is Marked 2 now. It's like $12. I shouldn't say like. It is $12. but it's worth it. It's such a huge jump from Mark 1.
Right. So at this point, it's probably better to get it directly through what, like your website or something like that outside of the App Store?
Yeah, absolutely. Marked2app.com. The ultimate goal, and actually a promise to myself, is that there will always be feature parity between the App Store version and the direct version. And the benefit to the direct version is instant updates.
Right.
For the customer, I think it's actually better to be off the App Store. It's not as convenient. Like, people like the convenience of the App Store updates.
Right.
But if you have an app that has built-in Sparkle updates and it checks every time you launch to see if there's a new version, it's actually, to me, it's more convenient. So I wouldn't discourage anyone from buying it directly right now, but if you prefer the App Store version, that would be available soon.
Yeah. That whole App Store thing, you know, I'm so conflicted on it, and I think a lot of us are, that, you know, it is the convenience of that, having kind of everything in one place. You know, it's almost more about the app management of it.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. It's like all my apps are managed there. I know what I bought. I can re-download stuff if I need it. There's one place to go to. And it's all convenient and excellent. But then you've got these other restrictions that, you know, I think it make it very hard for developers. So I commend you for you know, sticking to the feature parity thing, because I'm just finding, because of the system Apple's set up and because of some of the limitations, consumers are, I think, unknowingly in some cases getting shortchanged on their apps. And I think that's been a really unfortunate side effect, because I have so many people who are like, I bought this on the App Store and then I heard about this feature and then found out, well, that feature was only available if I bought it, you know, directly through the developer. And there's really no recourse or change. It's like the developer can't just go out and give them the other version. It's like, I got to rebuy it. Or You know, it's another one of these situations where Apple's kind of created somewhat of a mess for consumers.
Well, it's yeah, it may be in the current. I strongly believe that Apple is pushing us toward like the walled garden kind of platform where developers will no longer be able to do the things that we're doing outside of the App Store now. That could be way in the future. Right. And I'm actually starting to wonder if that's ever going to happen. Mm-hmm. But I think that was Apple's original intention, is to take full control of the environment. And I think they accomplished that within the App Store quite nicely. I mean, the real mess comes from people wanting to do things that Apple doesn't necessarily approve of, or for reasons, for future plans that they have, they want to avoid. I don't think it's the thing that bugs me most about the App Store is just search and discovery. Like, really, the only apps you're ever going to find that you're going to love are the ones that Apple picks and shows on the front page.
Yeah.
There, unless you're like me and you dig through page by page of every category to see what's come out and then you keep up with it, which no one else is going to do. Apps that don't get put on the homepage or don't get linked by, you know, Daring Fireball or Engadget or The Verge, they're gonna just disappear.
Yeah. Yeah, I found that I really get almost everything from outside the App Store. It's funny you mentioned that, because I was just going through that with the iOS, you know, App Store today. I was like looking through the top paid apps list and the top free apps list, and just looking at how much junk, like everything on the top free apps list now is all just Flappy Bird clones, right? It's right. Just like garbage. It's like, this tells me nothing. This is just...
And you can easily buy on the App Store a knockoff or a lesser version of the same concept without ever knowing the other one exists. And that, if you go to like Mac Update, they're going to show you, they let the customers say, this is related, or here's an even better one that does the same thing. Here's a cheaper way to do it, whatever. And you can see immediately, this isn't the one I want. This is the one I want. The App Store lets you just blindly... the search results are rarely good if you're searching for anything other than an app name. And the related apps are, they're vague and incomprehensible to me.
Yeah. This is where I probably need to throw a plug in, at least for iOS apps. I don't know if you've heard, or Michael Johnston, who does the We Have Communicators podcast, was frustrated by this thing and ended up creating, it's a web app right now and a website, but a service called Appler at getappler.com. And it's specifically to manage this. What it'll do is, you know, you can plug in your iTunes credentials and it will pull in all of the stuff that you've bought and then allow you to sort of rate it, you know. And it's just a three rating system. It's either you recommend it, you don't recommend it, or it's so-so. And then you can comment on it, and other people can comment on it, and you can follow people. So it's more of this word of mouth kind of recreating online the word of mouth recommendations that we all use. I mean, that's how I find most of the apps and stuff, is either word of mouth recommendations or podcasts where, you know, I trust the person, the host who's doing the podcast, is knowing what he's talking about. Or like you said, blogs. I mean, Tua is a great source, but you're right. Unless you see those recommendations or get them, there's no way you're going to know. The average customer stumbling into the App Store is just there at a big disadvantage.
There were a couple websites that did similar. Not too long ago, there was one that would import, but it failed at a lot of things. And this sounds like maybe a reincarnation that would solve some of the issues it had.
Yeah, we're hoping. It's just not gaining traction in terms of users so far. And, you know, it kind of depends on enough people knowing about it and participating for it to really work. And that's the one downside. But I love it. I mean, I use it now to find a lot of new apps and to figure out what's great is that you can ask that question. And also, there's a really easy system for linking to an alternative app. So because the database has all the apps in it, if you're writing a comment, you can create an app link. So if someone has, you know, bought something or recommended something, someone else can come in and say, hey, that's really great. Or, you know what, I found this has these limitations. You might want to take a look at this one, right? And it links it links over to the other app. So just like you were kind of talking about. So Hopefully.
I'll check it out. I might drop a link to it on iText editors because that is such a... Have you ever seen that?
Mm-mm.
At brettterpstra.com/iOS-text-editors is a spreadsheet of iOS text editors. Surprise. That it's like a feature matrix. And we studied... There are, I think, 80 on there right now. And it goes through about 20 different features and charts them out and does a comparison table. And people always ask me when I'm taking that to another level, adding more genres, adding more features to the matrix, things like that. And it would be great to have, if you like this and have more questions, head over here. So I'll take a look at it.
Right. Wow, that's cool. No, I was unaware of this page.
It was originally crowdsourced. I set up a Google spreadsheet and had people start adding editors and checking off features. And then that website is actually generated from a Google spreadsheet. I have a script that downloads the spreadsheet every time I build it and updates the whole chart. So it's really, if I need to change something, I go into Google and I change it in one cell and then type build deploy and it's done.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking at this too, and this also just sort of shows the symptom of the problem, right? It's just like, look how many text editors are here. Like, if you were just stumbling into the App Store without a resource like this, how would you know?
Right. Well, yeah, you'd never find them all, for one. And what iText editors lacks is reviews and crowd ratings. But that was intentional. Like, I do not pick favorites on here.
Right, yeah.
People always ask me, well, which one do you like? And I'm always hesitant to answer that. I have an answer, but it's, you know, there are multiple ones that are worth seeing, so why not put them up and let people make kind of rational comparisons and find the features they need and see what's available and then research them further.
Yeah, this is much more objective. You see what features each one has at a glance, and then you can decide which ones are... Because everybody's going to have certain features that are going to be important to them or not important to them.
And going through it on the App Store and loading each one, and like, all you really see is what they think is important to tell you.
Right.
Like, someone may have, like, you know, like full Dropbox support with all folders versus Sandbox, but they might not mention that in their marketing text. And if that's what you're looking for... Even if you found the right one, you wouldn't know it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think the last thing I just want to ask you about is, and I recognize you, so you went solo in January?
Yes.
So you haven't been doing it for too long. But another common thing that I found is just once you're on your own, right, your only boss is yourself. So when we work a day job, you're typically assigned projects and you have deadlines and you have all those sorts of things. So how have you found or are there any tips or tricks that you found for sort of figuring out how to prioritize things, how to manage your time, organization, that sort of stuff? Because that's something that I struggle with.
Well, I talked to Marco Arment right when I first did this.
Right.
And about that topic. And his answer was, well, I asked him if he... like set up like a grid for his time. Like, today I'm going to write, today I'm going to develop, etc.
Right. Yeah.
And he said, no, he said he couldn't do that. And I said, I'm going to try it anyway. And he's right. you have to work on what makes sense at the time. And that's something I've said for a long time. Like, do in any given moment, do what your brain wants to do. I mean, as far as work goes. That way you're going to be efficient, you're going to be invested in what you're doing. And for me, that always works out, because there are times I'm interested in one thing and times I'm interested in another. This last month, though, it's been kind of... I've been working on... Okay, I've avoided as many deadlines as possible. Mm-hmm. I haven't taken freelance jobs. I haven't taken contract jobs. The only deadlines I have are with publishers. And those deadlines are still enough to make my brain want to do anything but what I need to finish, which has always been a problem for me, but it's never been amplified to this point. As soon as I think, oh man, I got to have a draft of that chapter by Friday, my brain wants to work on Marked.
Right. Right.
And,
yeah.
And based on my philosophy, my longstanding philosophy, I work on Marked. I do things that, you know, actually need to be done with Mark, just not the things that have any kind of deadline. So I'm still working on how to get myself to prioritize. The confusion for me is that Mark makes me money just as much as any other deadline-based project.
Right.
And so it's not like I'm wasting time. It's not like I'm playing and doing crossword puzzles. I'm making money. It's just it doesn't have that added pressure. So I think my brain is more apt to lean towards doing things that are purely my own pursuit, yeah. Which is what I want to be doing right now anyway. But I also really want to write, and there's not a lot of self-publishing options that are worthwhile. So
yeah. Yeah, I ended up kind of the same way. You know, I tried to do the whole thing. I think there was an app called, an iOS app called 3030 that would kind of, where you could literally micromanage. I got to a point where it's like, oh, I got to micromanage my day, and I'm going to block out, you know, from this time to this time, I'm going to have breakfast. And from this time to this time, I'm going to answer emails. And from this time to
that.
Well, I tried that. That just did not. No, I can't either. Maybe some people can, but what I have learned and sort of found over the time is exactly what you're saying. Is I kind of need to work on what excites me at the time, because then I'm going to be motivated to work on it. The one dilemma that I got into that I now am working really hard to avoid is what I call interrupt-driven workflows, right? Because you're gonna start in on something and something else is gonna happen. It for me, in my case, because I have clients, it's a client calling or an email coming in, or it could even be a tweet, you know, coming in. I have to sort of go, okay, I am gonna work on this today, or I am gonna work on this for the next, you know, however long I want to work on it. And I have to turn off all of those other things. You know, I have to learn to filter those other things out, which is really hard for me to do. You know, because a phone call will come in and I'll see, oh, it's my client. But I've learned, you know what? I'm not going to pick that up, because my first instinct is, oh, I need to pick that up. And that's been really helpful for me, because the other thing I've learned in the process is, like, you think these things are urgent, right, at the time that they're happening, but very often they're not.
Right.
And once you get that in your head, it's like, you know what, I can get to that tomorrow. Like, they'll leave a voicemail if it's really important, or they'll send me a text or whatever. And I can ignore that text too, because whatever they're worried about is not going to, you know, is going to still be there 3 hours from now. And I can deal with that 3 hours from now and not take myself out of this mode. But I found I would get really inefficient, because I had this process where I'd be working on something and then I'd be off on something else, and then suddenly you forget what was I working on originally. And
I spent hours building a system called What Was I Doing? And it is designed, and I've actually spent some time in the last month kind of embellishing on it, but it's designed to allow interruptions. It's designed to be able to constantly go back and see what you were just doing, plus be able to take a look back at maybe you pulled an all-nighter.
Right.
And you, the next morning, you can't remember what all you did.
Right.
For me, that's not uncommon. So that's what the system is for. Kind of because I can turn everything off, but there are still interruptions, even if they're mental on my part.
Right.
But yeah, quieting things down, realizing. It's like realizing it's just a website. It's also realizing that when someone sends you an email, rarely are they expecting a reply in 15 minutes.
Yeah.
They will be happy if you reply the next morning. And it's hard for people like me to understand that. Like, for me, if someone asks a question, they need an answer.
Right.
And I get into the habit of watching. So, yeah, I do. I use, like, Desktop Curtain from Many Tricks, and I use hiding all my apps and quitting all my apps and just working. That's the only way I can do it. So we're on the same page there.
I think that's kind of key when you're working for yourself, because again, you're only responsible for yourself. And that one lesson, like realizing none of this stuff is urgent, because we've gotten into the sort of society with technology, we do have immediate access to information, and people have immediate access to us and stuff like that. And you do kind of struggle and fight against that. So I guess that's a good way to go. Well, Brett, I think we're going to wrap it up here. I really appreciate you coming on and kind of talking through some of this stuff. It was very, very informative for me and interesting. And I think a lot of people are going to get a lot out of this, because, like I said, I get asked all the time about sort of jumping into your own thing, you know, moving from that day job into kind of doing your own thing. Just in closing, you want to let people know sort of where they can find out more of what you're up to, maybe some of the other projects you're working on, your social media stuff, if they want to follow you, all those sorts of things.
Okay, so this is pretty easy. You can find me and all of my kind of mad science on the Mac at brettterpstra.com. It's brettterpstra.com. And then I am TT Scoff on every social service you can imagine. It never changes. Always TTSCOFF. And then I'm also at 5by5.net/systematic. Oh, I'm sorry, 5by5.tv/systematic, where my my weekly podcast is.
Yeah, great podcast too. Plug Macworld, since Macworld's coming up. Because I haven't looked over the thing. So you said you're speaking at Macworld. What are you talking about?
I am. I'm doing a talk called "The Efficient Mac User: OS 10 Tips for Getting More Done with Less Work," and it's basically the result of me watching over people's shoulders on airplanes and things, and seeing all of the things that they do inefficiently or that they could be doing better, and compiling notes rather than interrupting them and being a stranger telling them how to use a keyboard shortcut. I put together this talk about common things that every average user can do better, and then it's going to at the end head into some more advanced things with app recommendations and such.
Awesome. So you suffer from that impulse too, to like when you see somebody doing something, you're like, want to walk over and tell them to stop.
I've accepted the impulse. I've learned not to act on it. I've learned to find more productive outlets.
You mostly just get dirty looks, and they're like, "Who are you?" So you turn it into a Macworld talk. There you go.
Yeah.
Cool. That's awesome. I look forward to that. I'll be at Macworld, so we'll see you there. We'll hang out and have a beer or something like that. Thanks. Thanks, Brett. I really appreciate it. Take care.
Thank you.
So there you go, Brett Terpstra. Be sure to check out his podcast. Also, check out his website for all his projects. You'll be blown away by all the things that Brett has put together. And I look forward to, now that he's full-time doing this stuff, just the amazing things that I know he's going to be producing, because the guy is just super smart and talented and can really crank stuff out. So there's going to be some good stuff coming out from Brett Terpstra, I'm sure, in the future. And also, if you are at Macworld, be sure to check out his talk and come by and say hi to me. I'm looking forward to Macworld coming up here in just about a month now. We're only about a month away. Macworld iWorld in San Francisco, if you're going to be there. Shoot me an email ahead of time. Maybe we can make some time to meet somewhere on the show floor. I'm going to be running around grabbing interviews as normal. So be sure to watch your feeds for those, because that's my way of kind of giving you a virtual taste of Macworld. I try and ferret out some of the more interesting booths and products and things like that I notice or find as I'm walking around the show floor. And I've been doing that for a few years now, and that is always fun. But that's going to do it for now. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Smile, be sure to check out PDF Pen, the entire PDF Pen family of products. PDF Pen for your Mac, for your iPad, for your iPhone. Also PDF Pen Scan Plus, as well as their other applications, Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, and Disk Label. You can find out more information and details on all of their software over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets online. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. Big thank you to you for your support, for listening, for staying subscribed, and also for sending in all your great emails and audio comments. I look forward to getting those every week. So if you have a question, a comment, something you'd like to hear covered on the MacCast, you can shoot your email to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you prefer to use Skype, you can Skype me at the MacCast, and there's voicemail there, so you can just Skype in, leave a audio comment. Also, be sure to check out the MacCast website. That's at maccast.com. There you'll find the show notes. Also, the MacCast forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online, I'm on all the regular social media. It's MacCast most places, but on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. The Facebook page is at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And there is a MacCast Google Plus community. Just search for MacCast on Google Plus and you'll find us there. But that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.